Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2014. Lecture 3, delivered on September 25, 2014. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates and Risk.
Today, interest rates and risk. Before I get to that topic, go back to where I was last week, I do want to ask a quick question just to sort of get a basic concept clarified before we move on to more exciting things. Sir, what is money?
Currency?
You mean like checks aren't money?
I guess it is, yeah.
Yeah?
Something you could buy something with?
Oh, now there's, you're getting a little bit closer there. Yeah, that's not bad. Madam, do you have an idea? What's money? What's money?
Are you talking about like bills?
No, I'm talking about money.
I don't know, exchange, kind of, you said exchange for currency.
There we go. You're actually on the right track there. Money is technically anything that's accepted in exchange for something else. Anything that's accepted in exchange for something else. So in other words, I take you on as as my slave, and then I decide I'd really rather have, you know, a nice car. So if I can find someone who will take you as the slave in exchange for the car, your money. That's how diffuse the concept of money is. Now, when we want to get technical with money, then we have to break down money into different kinds. And I'm going to do it on a couple of dimensions here. And then I'll talk about how we do it, how the government breaks down money into different dimensions. And I'm going to give you an assignment to read one of my articles from some years back. But, okay, the first kind of money that we could talk about is a primitive kind of money that's still around to this day, a very primitive kind of money. It's called barter money. Barter money. I went out and I killed a moose. Now, you are a guy who makes apple pies. And you like moose meat, I like apple pies, so I come up to you and I say, I've got a moose. And you say, I've got pies. And so I slap that moose down and you twirl a couple of apple pies at me. And we've got a deal. That's barter money. Barter money. It's characterized by this, by the almost obvious fact about it, you can tell it when you see it. It is consumable. You can use barter money for more than just an exchange, but it is accepted. We accepted each other's goods, so those were money. So it was accepted. That makes it money. And because we could consume it, we could eat. You can eat a moose, I can eat a pie. That is barter money. Barter money. And a lot of you have done barter money in your lives, and it still exists in many cultures as the primary medium of exchange. And interestingly enough, in our economy, when you see the economy turning down, the numbers actually overstate the downturn, because a lot of times when times get bad, people move away from traditional economic transactions that we can record, and they move towards transactions that involve barter money that is not recorded. So in bad times, people tend to use barter money, which is off the grid kind of money. And then in good times, they don't use that kind of money very much. So there's a little bias in our numbers that way. Barter money. Now, there's the next kind of money is metal money. Metal money. Sometimes this is called commodity money, but that's a little bit tricky to use that term. I think the book actually calls it commodity money. So keep that in mind. Put that in parentheses. Metal money is money that has metal in it. Now, interestingly enough, it still has some intrinsic value. The metal could be used for something other than money. So if you have a silver coin, you can pound that coin into a nice little silver plate to put your espresso on. Or you could pound it into a spearhead so that you could skewer someone you didn't like. The metal money still has some intrinsic value, but not as much as... Did I just have a... The hell are you talking about? Lord, let me reduce this screen here. Anyway, metal money, it still has some intrinsic value, some usability of its own. As a matter of fact, we will even find sometimes in cultures at war, we'll find the evidence of their spearheads and their arrow points, and we'll see engravings on them. They took metal money and pounded it into weaponry. It's not unusual to do that. During the Civil War, you melted down anything you had for musket balls. And in the Revolutionary War, that was done too. So metal money is accepted in exchange, still has some intrinsic value, although it's not as consumable as barter money. The last kind of money is fiat money, which is actually, fiat, but everyone says fiat these days, so whatever. This is money that is money only by decree of a sovereign. So this is fiat money. It has absolutely no intrinsic value. Well, I suppose you could use it for toilet paper or something like that, but realistically, no value of its own. It is money only because we're ordered to accept it in exchange. Remember, the characteristic of money is anything that is accepted in exchange. Well, this is money because we are ordered to accept it in exchange. So this would be an example of a fiat money. No intrinsic value whatsoever, but it's still money because it's accepted in exchange. So those are the three kinds of money. Now let me take you down another path. Measuring money a different way. This is more of an official way to talk about money. Someone brought up the term currency. That is, when we're talking about currencies, back in the day, this would have been before any of you were alive, our coins were actually metal monies. They had silver in them, gold, they had usable metals. They stopped doing that in the mid-1960s because it turned out that the metal was more valuable than the coins themselves, so they stopped doing it. But we're talking generally these days, all of these measures are fiats, these things that I'm talking about here. When we want to know how much money is in the economy or how much money the Federal Reserve is printing or something like that, or how much money people are spending or earning. We're talking about an official kind of fiat money, government fiat money. The first measure that we would use is M0. This is one, I don't think the book even brings this up, and even the Federal Reserve tends not to report this very directly. You have to dig around to find this one. Yeah. This is a measure of official government fiat money. Now, I'm glad you stopped me there. These are in order of liquidity. Remember, liquidity is the efficiency with which you can change an asset. These are, as I go down the list, they become more illiquid. M0 is the most liquid of our money aggregates, as we say, money aggregates. And I ought to put that up there. That sounds really cool when you say it in a singles bar. Yes, we talked about money aggregates today. And by God, that was an interesting subject. No, M0, it's the base currency, just dollars and coins. Base currency. It's just dollars, just the paper and the coins. That's all it is. And as I said, interestingly, it's not that easy to find M0. Usually, you hear economics textbooks, government reporting, the Federal Reserve's reporting. It all is done starting with M1. But M0 is the fundamental money in your pocket kind of stuff. And when it does, it's been doing some strange things the last few years. And I'm not exactly sure why it's been doing the things it is, but it can't be good news when it starts doing strange things like that. But anyway, that's your base currency. Now, the one that usually, like textbooks, the Federal Reserve, the first one that they report is M1. This is M0, the base currency, plus a couple of other animals that are in there too. Demand deposits. That's checking accounts at banks. And it also includes traveler's checks, which used to be really a big thing, but I don't know. Have any of you ever used traveler's checks when you went to another country? It used to be almost everyone had used them, but like they're not very common now, but they are very liquid. All of this, don't get me wrong, is liquid. Obviously, M0 is liquid. Now, let me talk about demand deposits. Demand deposits are checking accounts at banks. They are not checking accounts at credit unions. Because a demand deposit at a bank, I write you a check for $100. You can walk to my bank, and with proper ID, you can demand the $100 in money right there and then, and they have to satisfy it. By law, they have to give it to you right there on demand. It's essentially what we call a bearer instrument. But if you have a checking account at a credit union, although they would almost always do it like a bank, they don't have to. That checking account at a credit union is actually more theoretically illiquid than a demand deposit checking account at a bank. As a matter of fact, it used to be the rule that they couldn't even say check. A bank could use the word check, spell it that way, but if you were at a credit union or some other institution that had things like checks, they had to spell them like this to distinguish between a real check and what you had, what you were writing, or what you had from a credit union. These are technically called, at credit unions, and I'll write this on the next line for M2, they're called NOW accounts, N-O-W, negotiable order of withdrawal. But I'll write that on the next line because they're the next one down. Although theoretically, although practically, a checking account at a credit union, it's the same as a checking account at a bank. They don't have to honor it. But if it's a real demand deposit, they do have to honor that thing right off the bat. Right there on the spot. And traveler's checks are as good as money. They just turn into money. Although, interestingly, in recent years, I run into more and more places that refuse to take a traveler's check, even though they are supposed to. They're technically actually falling into illiquid territory now. I had a traveler's check for $20 I brought back one day, like 3 or 4 months ago. Couldn't find any place that would take it. They used to be taken just like money, but now, no. Okay. Then M2. This is M1. And in addition, it is NOW accounts and small time deposits. And when I say small, I believe that small would be like $1 million or less, like a CD for $1 million or less. In other words, you put the money in and there's a penalty if you want to get it out early. Negotiable order of withdrawal. Matter of fact, let me write that down. Now is negotiable order of withdrawal. Now, don't get me wrong. This is not some defect in credit unions. Credit unions are a great thing, and they're putting some pressure, much-needed pressure, on banks. Banks are responding by saying it's unfair because credit unions don't face the tax structure of banks, back and forth, but they are a great place to put money. But anyway, M2. So in other words, you've got more illiquidity. Notice you still have that liquidity from the originals, but you also have more illiquid instruments in here. Now the next one, M3. This is M2 plus large time deposits, which are highly illiquid, plus the 800-pound gorilla, the euro dollars. The euro dollars. Do you know what a euro dollar is? Okay. Just out of curiosity, I'm just kind of always interested because they are a huge monster. Woman, you're a Chinese manufacturer. You make toasters. I like your toasters, and I live in the United States. So what I'm going to do is I would like to buy one of your toasters. So you have it on the shelves here. Now it's in American dollars. Let's say it's 10 American dollars. So I buy that toaster for $10. You never see my $10 bill. You never see an American currency at all. What happens is the $10 goes to the People's Bank of China. You're the People's Bank of China, communist. And so you take that $10 and give her the equivalent in yuan, the Chinese currency. Okay? Then you keep the $10. That is a euro dollar. What's in a foreign bank, a foreign central bank, that's a euro dollar. Oh, well, that's 10 euro dollars. And then you are holding 10 euro dollars. Now, something that actually most people don't know is that an American dollar can't be spent anywhere but in the country of its minting. That's true of anything. A euro coin, just one of those euro things, you can't spend that in the United States. You can spend it in Europe, but not here. You have to turn it into American money. So those 10 euro dollars you have in foreign reserve, and that's what it's called, in the People's Bank of China that you're controlling, you can't do anything with that except bring it back here and spend it. So what are you going to do with it? Well, what the Chinese have been doing for years. They've been using that to lend us money so that we could have low taxes and high spending, run a couple of wars, hell, have some fun. So that we could do all kinds of things, so that you could have student loans, so that you could have cars, so that you could have borrow money for those. That was, a lot of that was euro dollars, money that was in foreign banks that we had transferred to them so that we could have their cheap goods. The OPEC nations have lots of euro dollars. We buy oil from them so that that money accumulates in their central banks, and then the only place they can use it is back here. So what do they do with it? They lend our government money to cover its deficits. They lend us money so that we think we're better off than we are. They buy stock in our corporations. They lend money to corporations that are issuing debt. Essentially, at the end of the day, those euro dollars make us the world's bitch. And the euro dollars are a major, major concern. Well, China's going to dump all of its dollars, and boy, are we... No, they're not. That would be suicide. They're not going to do that. They're not stupid. That's where all their value is in those euro dollars from us sending our dollars over there in exchange for their cheap goods. The Arab countries aren't going to dump our dollars. We're all integrated. We're all stuck together that way. They have our money, and so they use it to lend us money, so we have to pay them. We essentially transfer future obligations to them on our cash flows for the future, And in exchange, they give us cheap goods, cheap oil, cheap toasters, cheap everything. Those are euro dollars. Now, here's the interesting thing about these four metrics of money, these four money metrics. You can find the base currency. If you look hard enough, you'll find the numbers for the base currency. And M1 and M2 are reported by the government. Up until 2006, M3 was reported too by the government. But suddenly the government stopped reporting M3. And the reason was, they said, was no one ever looks at M3. No one cares about it, so we're not going to publish it. The actual reason was that M3 was growing at a rate that was approaching 20% a year. A staggering rate of growth. At the same time, starting a little earlier, M1 stopped growing. The Federal Reserve was not printing M1 money, the money that we use as businesses and individuals. We were creating a massive liquidity crisis. And that's one of the reasons I was predicting that there's going to be a collapse of the economy in 2008. Sure enough, we had this throttling of M1. It's supposed to grow at the real rate of growth of the economy so that we have enough money for all of our transactions. Instead, it was growing at an average rate of zero. So slowly, over a period of about 4 years, the economy was choked. Liquidity, we had a complete liquidity collapse. And so the banks and the other evildoers started doing wildly risky instruments and selling them to each other to raise a little cash to pay bills. And so you had the derivative crisis starting to develop. Because if you find a way to do anything that gets you money, real money, it sure wasn't coming from the Federal Reserve's printing presses, you'd do it. But at the same time, M3 was growing at a staggering rate. Now, here's something that will come up later in the course. If the money supply grows at a rate faster than the real growth rate of the economy, you'll have inflation sooner or later. The only thing that can cause inflation is the money supply growing faster than the real growth rate of the economy. Again, the only thing that can create inflation is the money supply growing faster than the real growth rate of the economy. Period. Well, raising the minimum wage is going to create inflation. No, it's not. It can't. Not unless the Fed has printed money to provide liquidity for it. Well, that corporation jacked up its prices. That's inflationary. No, it's not. It can't be. If prices go up in one sector, if there's no more money, people will stop buying that stuff or they'll move to other products. That can't create inflation. The only thing that creates inflation is if the money supply grows at a rate faster than the real growth rate of the economy. So when essentially the control mechanism the Fed was using was to throttle M1 to zero, knowing very well that sooner or later that massive growth of liquidity down here in M3 would come back to bite us in the ass. So they were trying to do something about this, which they couldn't really control, by killing off the economy with something they could control. And, of course, that led to an insanely bad recession in 2008. And everyone looks around, well, the reasons for this were really complex. No, they're not. It was pretty easy. I can teach it in about 20 minutes in a finance class or an econ class. Right now my websites are down because of some asshole hackers, but I'm going to try to bring it up within the next couple of days so you can read the article I was just showing. Here are the charts. Here are the numbers. And then the Fed, of course, wasn't publishing M3 anymore, so I had to get that from another source called Shadow Government Statistics. But there you go. Anyway, enough of that. Did I really spit on that screen that much? Oh. Anyway. I'm going to show you something up here in just a minute, in just a little bit. But anyway, this is how we measure the money that is official money. But remember, there's always these monies out there that aren't being measured, like barter money. Most of you are going to engage in some barter contracts. In a bad economy, you're probably going to engage in more of those barter contracts than you do in a good economy. In a great economy, sir, you're going to have a regular job. But when the economy collapses, you lose your job. Does that mean you're going to starve to death? No. You're going to provide male gigolo services in exchange for love and access to a refrigerator. Okay? You see the idea? That money, as we technically define it, isn't really all the money there is out there. And even at that, and I'll try to get to this at the end of this course, there's all this stuff out there that's like zombie money. I don't know what else you would call it. But it's being swapped and traded, and it's like it's not being measured. All these instruments that are being used, derivatives swap for derivatives, there's no real money measurement able to encompass that, and yet that's billions, trillions of dollars. Plus, we've also got these things showing up now like Bitcoin and that kind of money. Have any of you ever used Bitcoin money or anything like that? A few people have. It's actually, eventually, it's going to take a legitimate place in the spectrum of money. Right now, it's not there, but a lot of places that are reputable are collecting Bitcoin money in reserves, including some of our big brokerage houses and investment banks, are collecting reserves of these internet virtual monies just on the outside chance, well, not on the outside chance, just to make sure that they have that kind of money available to them. Okay, back to interest rates. Now, I'm going to refresh on that last topic that I did there, that the risk-free rate is the real rate of return plus the expected inflation premium. And again, the real interest rate is the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. What your reward is for giving up money. Now, the use of money now. There's a completely different way of looking at it, though. The real interest rate is the intersection of the supply of and demand for money. So, the way I explained it last time, the real interest rate is the reward that you must have for giving up money, the use of your money for a while. Taking everything else aside, expected inflation, risks in it, it's just your raw opportunity cost of foregone consumption. That's a real rate. But there's another way of looking at it too. An interest rate is the price of money. It's a rental rate. Interest rate is a rental rate on money. That's all it is interest rate. The interest rates are rental rates on money. Now, the base rental rate would be driven by the supply of and demand for money. So I could say, all right, here's money on this axis, the horizontal axis. And here is this real interest rate. There is a demand for money. Now, I'll bet this, you saw this, you can confirm this for me. And here is the supply of money. And they draw the supply of money as a straight up and down line, saying, well, at any given point in time, there's just a fixed amount of that out there. Were you shown this graph in your econ classes? Yeah, this is kind of a traditional thing. Okay, so the real interest rate is simply this, where the supply and the demand, and we'll mark this as 1. So, if we hold the demand constant, if the Federal Reserve wants to stimulate the economy by lowering interest rates, it would print more money. Increasing the supply. Like that. Okay? Drop the interest rate. And, of course, there will be lower interest rates, and you'll borrow to get that great car that you were thinking of. Although I would strongly recommend against a Prius. Really, a Prius? They actually recall for ugly, you know. But I'll stimulate the economy. So once the Federal Reserve saw that the, that the thesis hit the fan in the autumn of 2008, suddenly they found Jesus. And they started printing money like there was no tomorrow to try to dig out of the liquidity mess that they had created over the past 4 years or so. They started printing money like there was no tomorrow to drive down interest rates. Okay? And interest rates went down. They started giving banks money for free or on insanely low terms at the discount window. Well, the banks will then lend us money out at low interest rates and everything will come back to life. Unfortunately, that was where the glitch occurred because the banks didn't lend the money out. They got it at virtually zero interest, and then you know what they did with it? They invested it in stock, in securities, in foreign reserves, in all kinds of things, instead of putting it back into the economy. Well, we can't take a chance on American consumers and businesses because, you know, there's a recession and those people are going into bankruptcy. They didn't lend the money out. So the Fed just kept cranking the supply of money outward, farther and farther. Out. Farther. Interest rates kept going down. Of course, as real interest rate went down and there was no inflation expectation, the risk-free rate, like the rate on a treasury bill, they were going down. My favorite story is 2009. I was teaching an econ course and I had a student who was working at one of the banks here in town. Now, banks, the way they have to keep a certain amount on reserve. At the end of every night, they have to have a certain amount of money in their reserves. And so and it can be actual cash money or it can be treasury bills. So they got all their, what they thought would be enough for the night. And then the lady that was in my class, she actually came to my office late and she said, I got to get back, but I need some help. What's going wrong with these Excel spreadsheets? I don't know how those work. And you're not even supposed to be showing stuff like that. She said, I don't care. Every time I do this calculation, I'm coming out with the treasury bill rate. We bought treasury bills, and the yields on them are negative. Negative. She said, that's wrong. Something in the Excel spreadsheet's wrong. And I gave a quick call, and I found out, yeah, this is one of the days when interest rates are negative. The risk-free rate actually became negative. It slipped slightly into negative territory and bounced back up to slightly positive. The mean of it is about zero. In other words, if you lend the government money, you are going to get a zero rate of return on that money. The money supply has been cranked out that much, filling that liquidity hole that was created through the years of throttling M1 in negative interest rates or zero interest rates. So in other words, you lend the government $1,000, buy a T-bill that's going to pay $1,000 in a year, you'll probably pay $1,000, maybe $1,002 for it today. In other words, you're either getting no interest or zero, or negative interest. There's a sign on one of the banks. You go down the street and you'll see these signs. We're paying this on CDs. There's a bank not far from campus here. 1 year CDs are paying a whopping 1% interest right now. Now, if you think about that, inflation is running at about 2.2 to 2.7%, depending on how you look at it. So in other words, you are losing money by putting money into those CDs now. What does that mean? Buy food, buy cheeseburgers, buy whatever. Because if you put your money in the bank, you actually will have less money adjusted for inflation in a year than you will right now. That's how severe they've been pushing that money supply curve outward. Like I said, just frantically trying to keep the economy. You've heard that old saying, I looked into the abyss and the abyss looked back at me. Well, that's not what happened in 2008. We looked into the abyss and the abyss farted at us. So ever since then, we've been trying to fill the hole so we don't have to have the abyss fart at us again. It's that serious what's been happening out there. The Fed's just shoveling money in. And interestingly enough, it's not helping the economy because essentially now that banks can do investment as well as banking, they're just taking the money that the Fed is pouring through them that's supposed to go into the economy, and they're just pouring it into stocks. That's why the stock markets are skyrocketing. It's just pure inflation because the money is not going to the economy. That's why we still have the high levels of unemployment and all of that. And lectures like this is why I don't get invited to those nice professor conferences at the Fed. Okay. So in other words, by the way, what we're actually seeing is that the money supply has gone so far out that basically it's almost like the whole concept of demand is not even there anymore. It's just like, does the demand curve actually go into negative territory so you can have an intersection down here? Apparently, if that's maybe, whatever. Okay. This right here, this K sub F, is the first interest rate we ever see with our eyes. It's the Treasury bill rate, basically the risk-free, a short-term T-bill. That would be so if I ever say, you'll have a couple of formulas in this class where part of the formula is the risk-free rate, K sub F. You'll see that as the formula. So whenever you see that, just look for where I tell you what the T-bill rate is. That's what you plug in there. Okay, that's the basic rate. And I'm going to tell you something right now. You are never going to borrow money at the risk-free rate. You're not the government, and so you're never going to get that incredibly low rate. What you're going to get is some rate that is the risk-free rate at its core, but then there's going to be something out here. This is called the risk premium. It has three pieces to it. The risk premium has three pieces to it. The first one is one that actually government instruments would have. It's called the maturity premium, K sub M, the maturity premium. Now, let me explain this one to you, because even longer-term government instruments have this one. They don't have any of the others, but they have this one. Someone I haven't bothered yet. Okay, you, sir. Cubs, really? Okay, anyway. You are a bank, and I borrowed money on a home loan. Let's say a 30-year fixed-rate home loan. Okay, so you lent me money, and at the time we did this arrangement, the interest rate was 6% on my 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, okay? So now, you as a bank are expecting for the next 30 years a 6% return per year, and that's going to go on for 30 years. That gives you a lot of certainty in your planning. Great. Now, what happens if the Federal Reserve decides to punch money into the economy, interest rates drop, and I walking around, I see a bank that's offering money at 4%. As a matter of fact, you're now making new mortgage loans at 4%. And I'm walking around, and I've got a 6% loan with you, and I see 4% mortgages. What am I going to do? Refinance. You better believe I'm going to refile right away. So that 6% you were expecting, you get that money back, and what can you lend it out at now? just 4%. I screwed you. Meaner. Okay, now, let's say it goes the other way, and the Federal Reserve clamps down on the money supply, gets scared about inflation finally coming along, and so it jacks interest rates up, and interest rates go up to, let's say, 9%. Now, here's a little thing from real estate finance. You ought to take some. I teach a great real estate finance course. But the average homeowner holds a loan for 7 years before they move and the loan is closed with the sale of the house. About 7 years. But what happens if I'm a homeowner and at year seven, interest rates have skyrocketed on new mortgages? What am I going to do? You better believe it. That's home sweet home. Love that damn place. I'm going to stay there until Jesus comes back. And so you were expecting at about year seven that you would get your money back and you'd be able to reinvest, lend it out again. And interest rates are at 9%. You mwahahaha. He's going to sell his home and I'll get that money back so I can lend it out. No, I'm going to stay right where I am. I'll dig underground and build something. I'll add on to the top of the house. I'll throw the kids out and tell them to get a job. I'll stay where I am. So look at what happens. The banker here, no matter which way interest rates swing, I screw him. Now, interestingly enough, notice that the longer the debt instrument is, the more chance there is for interest rates to move. So in 1 year, interest rates probably aren't going to go very far. In 5 years, a little farther. In 30 years, there's all kinds of insane things that could happen to interest rates. And not one of them is good for you. So the maturity premium is simply an additional charge for bearing risk of interest rate volatility. For bearing risk of interest rate volatility. And there's always a higher chance that something is going to happen in 30 years than in 1 year. You leave this building, there's a very, very, very small chance that you're going to get hit by lightning. But over 30 years, decent. That's why I follow you with my camera. YouTube would love something like that. Okay, but it's 30 years, and that's a long time to wait. Over a single year, there's very little chance that you'll get cancer. But over 30 years, you're going to die. Uh-huh, yes, you are. You see, the thing is that longer periods of time give more chance for the risk exposure to become a reality. And so interest rate volatility, over a year, you lend me money for a year, there's... You know, interest rates aren't going to wildly whip around for that a year. But for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, there's a good chance that something is going to happen. Stories along this line about insurance risks. So, for example, you insure one of the Twin Towers. You don't charge all that much for insurance. Yeah, it's a big, huge amount, but I mean, what's the chance of one of the towers falling? Ever. And I mean, you don't insure both of them because what's the chance of both of them falling at the same time? Oops, they did. Damn. Okay, another one. Over a small period of time, there is not going to be any bad earthquake out here. But if you read about the history of Illinois and Missouri, I read the letters that were written at the time of the great earthquake in the early 1800s. I swear they were writing like modern apocalyptic novelists describing entire cities in ruins and smoking and death everywhere. And then the earthquakes just kept coming. And then the rains came. And then more of these earthquakes. And then the Mississippi River flowed backwards. It actually didn't flow backwards. The earthquake was so powerful that it threw the water of the Mississippi up north, and then it all gathered up there and then came south like a tidal wave. That's not going to happen in a year again, 5 years. But over a period of 200, 500 years, it will happen again right here in this part of the country. And it'll be even worse this time because back then it was just human lives lost and a lot of animals. Well, this time, you see, we've got all these pipelines crisscrossing right through the heartland of America from coast to coast, gas, hydrocarbons of all kinds, and all that kind of stuff. Well, those will snap if the New Madrid fault line breaks again. And then it will be real. On the bright side, you'll die very, very quickly, and there won't be any need to bury your ass. Okay? Barbecue, anyone? So that brightens your day, sure. But anyway, that's the maturity premium, okay? Now there are two more. You, sir, are a fine credit risk. You'll pay off your bills. But you're going to default on me, okay? I know that. You just got that dodgy look on your face. And you, I don't trust you either. But you see, there's going to be some people who don't pay off some of their debt or all of it. So everyone is going to have a little bit of a risk premium in there to cover the probability that all or part of a cash flow isn't going to be paid back. That's a default premium. The default premium. Now, it's going to be very small for some kinds of instruments. It's going to be huge for other kinds of instruments. So, for example, let's talk about a house, a home loan. The default premium. Well, a lot of people stopped paying their payments and they got foreclosed. So these poor banks lost tons of money. Well, first of all, no for two reasons. No for reason number one is that there was an asset that could be liquidated. That will tend to bring down the default premium if there's something that they can take back. And second, the one that, no matter how many times I have talked to journalists about this, banks have an insurance contract. You pay the premiums so that if you default, they have an insurance company that pays them the difference between what they can sell the house at and what you owed on the loan. So if you default, you owe $180,000, and when they sell it again, they can sell it for only $160,000. You, the borrower, were paying insurance premiums in case you did that. So the bank is just going to go to the insurance company and say, pay up the $20,000 that was the delta on the loan. Hardly anyone knows that, which is, it just staggers me. These banks' crocodile tears, they were covered. As a matter of fact, I wrote my dissertation pricing that insurance. The big insurance company that does this is MGIC. Now, here's a little personal tip. If you get a loan and you have to borrow more than 80% of the value, you have to have this insurance. It's part of the loan agreement. And you pay the monthly premiums. It's right in your loan payment. You pay the insurance premiums. Now, interestingly enough, though, most people don't even know they have this, that they're paying this extra. So when they're paying off their loan, when they go below 80%, they don't have to pay it anymore. They can cancel that insurance premium requirement. But most people never do. They pay off the whole damn loan, and for the entire 20, 30 years, they were paying an insurance premium that they didn't have to pay after the 7th or 8th year of the loan. That is rather interesting. So if you borrow money, keep your eye on the contract. One, try to do 20%, because at that point, they're not going to charge you they can't charge you the insurance premium. And two, if you're above 80% loan-to-value ratio, then watch your loan value, and once you cross that trigger at 80%, you say, I need you to cancel the magic, the MGIC, the Mortgage Guarantee Insurance Company stuff on that. It'll save you some actually rather surprising bucks on the loan. But there you go. Okay, so the default premium on an asset-based loan would be lower than the default premium on a non-asset-based loan. Let's go then to this. What about a car loan? Big default premium or low default premium? On it. Say it? No. would actually be in the middle. And here's why. There's an old rule. You drive a car off the lot, 15% of the value is gone as soon as it leaves the lot. So there is this immediate drop in the value of the asset there. So that if you do default on it and they take it back, they are going to take something back that they can't sell as high a price as they. And there's another thing too. And this goes to what the car is worth if they have to repo it. In my case, I go to Chicago, I buy White Castle cheeseburgers. Takes about an hour before they begin to hit the parts of me that make bile. Do you really think that car is going to sell for a good price when the prospective buyer of it? Yeah, this car was taken from some asshole who teaches at ISU. Oh, my God. Oh, God. Shut it. Yeah, the cars can be not in very good shape. They tend to be able suffer more material damage. A house, when you repo it, it's still pretty much a house. Unless you lived with a whole bunch of beavers in the basement, it's probably going to still be in about the same condition. But a car, once it is off that lot, you're probably going to do all kinds of things in there that I don't even want to hear about. I don't want to see you putting them on Twitter, okay? So it's going to lose more value. So there is more of a default premium. Now, credit card, going to have a very high default premium simply because it's an uncollateralized loan. That's why those credit card rates are like 18.99% and something like that. In the intermediates, student loans. Now, they don't have a very high default premium these days because the government's underwriting them. That's also the case with a lot of home loans, FHA, VA loans. The government's backing those loans, so the bank's not going to lose its shirt on those anyway. But on student loans, the government has actually taken over the entire main program. And the government's not going to charge you much of a default premium because if you don't pay the loan, they're going to send a SWAT team to shoot your ass. Quite literally, they will get their money from you. You can't even go to bankruptcy and get out from under a student loan. That's how bad it is for you cats these days. So that's the default premium. It's there, but it's not the same on different types of loans. And finally, there's one, and I always have to watch myself because this book and a lot of other textbooks these days call it exactly the opposite of what I used to call it. The book calls it the illiquidity premium. And that's an L there because I used to call it the liquidity premium. Look, if you lend someone money, you don't have to ride that loan to the end. You can sell the contract to someone else. Like if you lend the government money on a 30-year bond, you probably won't keep that bond for 30 years. You'll sell it in a secondary market to someone else. And someone else becomes then the holder of the debt instrument, and the government has to pay them back. So, looking for someone who would be good for this. You, sir, come from an incredibly respectable family. You're a fine, upstanding stud, a member of the community, a Presbyterian. And you do everything right. Your family is good, everything. So you want to borrow some money. You promise to pay her back $100 in a year. Now you have your lawyer fix up a nice contract. It's got gold filigree on it, got some Valkyries floating on and all that. Wherefores and wherein's and all that kind of stuff and the who fart, it's all there. So she said, okay, I'll lend you $90, and you pay me back $100 in a year. That would be $10 interest on $90, so that'd be about 11%, okay? Now, I come up to you. I'm a street bum. You, woman, I need some money. A year, I'll give you $100 back in a year. I don't know how, but I'll give you $100 back in a year. I'll write you an IOU here. Let me find there's some toilet paper I got. Cool. I'm gonna IOU money. Yeah, I'll give you $100. Okay. Here's your damn IOU. Now lend me some money. You gonna lend me $90? Mm-hmm. What are you gonna lend me?
No.
Oh, bullshit. I mean, come on. Damn, after all we've had together. You're gonna lend me something. Maybe $50, $40. Okay, you got a dollar. For God's sake, I need coffee. But the point there is, you see that the interest rate she's going to charge me effectively. Suppose she lends me $40. So she's going to get back $60 in interest on a $40 investment. 60 divided by 40 is some stupid interest rate. Lousy person, you, user. You see, because if she needed her money back that she had lent to you, in 6 months, she could sell the document to you for maybe like $95 or something like that. And then you'd collect the $100 from him. You have a perfectly valid legal piece of paper and a very respectable person. He's probably going to take it. He'll be okay with that. But you could not find anyone who's going to take this promissory note off your hands. That means that the promissory note is illiquid. And that's about some kinds of loans. Almost all loans, banks get rid of them very quickly. Like a mortgage, you get a mortgage from a bank, that bank probably won't have that mortgage by the end of the day. It'll package it up with a bunch of other mortgages and sell it to the secondary mortgage markets. It doesn't even handle the loan anymore. All it does is take a fee for collecting the payments. But the loan is gone. It sold that instantly. Mortgage instruments are highly liquid. And that, so, and through Ginny Mae, Fannie Mae. And that was one of those scandals, these high-risk loans. They were all over the place. Well, there was a market for them. See, back in the old days, if a bank made a loan to a risky person for a house, they were married to that. They could get rid of the quality loans, but those high-risk loans, they couldn't do anything with them. They had to hold them, which means that they were taking on a risk that they really didn't want. And then a market developed for these high-risk loans. Giant investment groups were packaging those together and turning them into super bonds and then writing derivatives off them and then derivatives off the derivatives. So a market developed. They became liquid. So there was no longer a liquidity premium on those. Then other kinds of debt instruments that used to be very difficult for banks to get rid of or other kinds of financial institutions, suddenly they became easy. So there really are not a whole lot of instruments out there that carry a high liquidity premium. Truth of the matter is credit cards still are not that easy for banks to unload. So that's another reason they have a higher interest rate is because the banks are kind of married to those because they can't package those up and sell those to an investment group that likes that kind of risk. Although it's out there, those kinds are. They buy them at discounts. Anyway, those are the kinds of risks. And that's what creates an interest rate. Any interest rate you see has this thing at its core. That's going to be there. And then it has some combination of these. Government T-bills, all they have is this. Government notes and bonds have maturity premium in them. And then private loans, they'll have a default premium and maybe a liquidity premium. But that's how interest rates work. So here's a definition for you. Financial intermediation. Financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units. The matching of surplus and deficit economic units, taking into account the level, timing, and risk. Taking into account the level, the timing, and the risk. Financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units taking into account level, timing, and risk. So, in other words, oh, by the way, the book and a whole lot of ignorant resources on the internet says, uses in there in that definition somewhere, financial institutions. They do not have to be part of a financial intermediation. Let me explain. You need to eat tonight, and you don't have any money. Okay, I got some money. We might be able to work something out. You pay me back if you can. You need, let's say, $20. Okay, I got $20. Level. You need the money now, and you can pay me back in a couple of weeks. I can live with that. Timing. You're not the greatest person in the world, but I mean, you know, I know where you live, and I've got some old army buddies. We can go over to visit you if you don't pay me. So I can handle the risk. So there is a match. Level, timing, and risk. And notice that there is not some financial institution. Yeah, sure, they're involved many times, but I don't want you to have this impression that we all die if the financial institutions aren't there. We can do this. Okay, but at the same time, you need to borrow. You want to buy a house trailer. Okay, that's great. You have a need for money now. Now, it turns out that over your life, you're going to make multiples of what the house trailer would cost. But you don't have the money at the time you need it. So that's that timing thing in there. You see, different kinds of borrowers and lenders have different preferences. How much they lend, how they get the money back, how fast, and how risky. Some lenders love risk. Others are scared of it. It all has to do with what's going on with the particulars. So that's where financial institutions can help, or other financial intermediaries, is that they can make the matches in a good way, so that everyone's happy with how it comes out. But they are not necessary. So if in your definition, if I ask this on the first exam, what is financial intermediation? And you simply say, financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units, taking into account level, timing, and risk, I will love you. But if you put in financial institutions are involved in this in any way, shape, or form, I will turn into a raging beast, I will find you, and I will eat your ass. Yes, Gourmet is my middle name. Oh, also, one thing that's kind of interesting. He's going to get paid at the end of the month. He's got a big check coming in, but he doesn't have it now. So you see, a person can be a surplus economic unit and a deficit economic unit, sometimes at the same time. Many people in their 30s buy a home. They're a deficit economic unit with respect to a home purchase. But they've already got hundreds of thousands of dollars in a 401k, which is being lent for them to big, big things through some brokerage house. So they're a surplus economic unit in another dimension. So you can be both at the same time. But here is the last thing I want to show you today. You see, if I were to look at government instruments, the worst that they can have is a maturity premium in addition to that base thing. And that maturity premium should grow over time because of the concerns about more probability of high volatility of something adverse happening in the economy. So we have something that is called a yield curve. All a yield curve does is show the maturity of government instruments versus the yield on those, the interest rate on those government instruments. So it gives a sense of what the markets are thinking about what kinds of volatility, what probability of adverse interest rate swings up and down are going to be happening over a period of time. So, I'm going to show you something here. Really? Oh, isn't that just special? Oh, there we go. This right here is a yield curve. You see, this is a very short-term treasury bill This is a 2 year, a 4, 5 year, 7 year, on out to a 30 year T-bill. And you can see that the interest, the yield on them does rise. That's the maturity premium. Now, here's what we really are interested in. A couple of things. How steep is that yield curve? And how is it moving over time? And there are a couple of things that scare the living hell out of us. Something that could happen is a very weird thing called an inverted yield curve, where there's a part of the yield curve that dips under and then comes back up. I had been watching the yield curve in 2007, 2008. I'd been reporting. The yield curve was very flat in here, but it did not invert. Finally, technically for a couple of days, it inverted. And that's when I called that there's going to be a recession. Because every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. However, not every inverted yield curve has led afterwards to a recession. So it's a one-way street. But that yield curve had been floating flat as hell, and it was trying to drop under and come back up, and finally it did, and I called it. Even though maybe a recession wouldn't follow, there were so many other things saying we're going to have a recession that as soon as I saw the technical inversion, there was one instrument, a treasury bond out here, had a yield slightly lower than a treasury note did, just slightly. That's a technical inversion. That's all I needed to see. And I said, there's my last sign that a recession is going to come. Now, here's what we look at. Now, this is obviously, to some extent at least, kind of a healthy yield curve. Although, notice this part in here. See how steep it is there? You like to see these yield curves smooth, you know, kind of like. But this one is just racing upward in there, which tends to tell me that investors are expecting a rather sharp increase in interest rates over the next 5 years. That would probably be the Fed finally getting scared because it's printed all that money I was showing you. The Fed finally realizing, okay, we are doing nothing but creating inflation. Now let's look at what it's been looking like. Let's go clear out. This is what the yield curve looked like. I think they do this one 6 months. I'm not sure. Okay, 6 months ago, notice that the top, the yield curve out on the long end was much higher than it is now. And notice that the yield curve on the bottom end was lower than it is now. So in other words, if I move this back, you see how the top of it has been pulling downward? Look at yield curves, and they're one of your own personal tools that gives you some understanding and gives you a little bit of predictive power. Notice how the bottom of the top, the long end, see how it's sagging downward? And see how the short end is coming upward like that? That's a little bit concerning. That's where you begin to get that worry that, is this thing going to head for an inversion? Look at this middle here. See that flat part there? Let me pull this out. Oh, look at that. Look at how that middle part is flattening. If you keep one eye on that, if this long end and the intermediate end keep falling downward, and this middle part here keeps sagging like this, that to me looks like the warning sign that an inversion is down the road. Maybe a year, I don't know. And maybe it won't happen. But remember, if it does happen, that doesn't mean a recession is going to happen. But every recession has been preceded by an inversion. And what I'm looking at, I see a yield curve, look at that, that's acting like it wants to invert down the road, maybe a year, 6 months. What does that mean for you? 2 years, we're in another recession. That's when you're going to be out there trying to get a job. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.